Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast.
Well, we've had a busy week and a very good response to Andrew Gold.
Yes, another busy week. And we met a new friend, didn't we?
I can't remember which friend that is.
Oh, we have so many friends now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, our friend from Australia.
Shorter.
Yes.
Who from Australia, who is going to be joining us soon. About 50% of the comments on the Andrew Gold program are, yes, please talk to Shorter. She's fantastic. So we're going to do that. In fact, we're going to do a funny one, aren't we? We're going to do a kind of switch. We're going to talk to her, and then she wants to interview us. Goodness knows why, but she does. So we'll do that, probably in about...
So that'll be quite interesting. We always try to do things a bit differently.
We do.
But, I mean, Andrew's close to 5,000 views on YouTube just in a matter of days.
I know. It's mustn't get smug. I was just checking. A year ago, exactly, we were getting a couple of hundred views, and we were going on and on and on about getting subscriptions, and we had 450. So it's gone up quite a bit since then.
I think, what are we now, about 7,000?
Yeah, and we're very grateful to all of you.
Yeah, and we'd like to encourage you to push the like button, to make comments, to engage with us. We try and engage back, and to create a bit of a dialogue.
Yeah, we've had some great messages, actually. We were talking to Andrew about, you know, whether or not... people are more polarized than they used to be. Lioness 62555 thinks that they are. I love the Scandalmongers podcast. Good start. But you're not wrong. We used to have lots of civilized discussions in the 80s and loads of friends across the political divide. It's much more polarized now, driven by social media. Oh, lovely email we also got. Did you get more and more emails, I notice? This is from, I'm going to pronounce your name wrong, Françoise Hermite from Belgium. Thank you for listening from beautiful Belgium. Sending us loads of really good ideas about the Belgian royal family, which I think could be a fun episode.
Yeah. Well, we're struggling to find people to talk about European royals. We've been trying very hard to get Spanish experts. So any suggestions for, you know, whether it's Belgian, Spanish, Scandinavian, Dutch, we'd love to hear from you.
We would. We would. I've been in a few more charts. The usual ones. Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, Britain. But I think for the first time, we've appeared in the charts in Nigeria.
Gosh.
So maybe Andrew Gold has lots of fans in Nigeria. If you're listening in Nigeria, please let us know who you are.
Yes.
And what you want.
Yes. And maybe next week it'll be Rwanda.
Well, that's, for those who are following British politics, yes, indeed. It could well be. This is going to be a sensitive episode. It's an incredibly divisive subject, subject of trans rights and trans healthcare. Not something we've ever really thought about doing before, but we were so lucky to get access to Hannah Barnes, who's going to be our guest. One of the most distinguished reporters at the BBC, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, absolutely. And the timing is good because there's just been a report into this issue. And so it's been very much in the news, certainly in Britain. But she's a very measured, well, I think, and I hope, is going to be very measured about what she says.
Well, her book certainly is. And she was from BBC Newsnight, which is well known, I think, internationally, partly because of the Prince Andrew interview. But it is, or it was, until recently, one of the great homes of investigative journalism in Britain. And her work led to publish a book, which has been very influential. And we'll get into all of that. I just want to say something, if I may, Andrew, about my own personal feelings on this subject. I've been lucky enough to know two trans people in my life. And in both cases, it was completely obvious to me and everybody else who knew them that the care they got was valuable and effective. Now, I'm talking about hormonal treatments and surgeries. So they could live present in a different way to the gender in which they were born. And it's their lives have been massively improved. So, you know, I would never want to go against that. But of course, those people were adults who'd gone through puberty. And the issue that we're going to talk about with Hannah is about children. And some people have speculated that maybe our desire to support the trans people in their lives led us to be perhaps over-indulgent of some of the activists who were pushing some of the care that kids have been getting.
And not to listen to the science, or the scientists not listening to the science.
Yeah, that's right. We'll get into this with Hannah, but very long story short, biggest gender clinic in the world, I think, was at Tavistock in London. It used to treat a handful of usually boys who were having gender issues and felt they were unhappy and distressed at their, and wanted essentially to live and present as girls. But in the last 4 or 5, well, no, actually more like the last 10 years, huge number of girls appearing in what's called gender dysphoria. And a kind of system of affirmative healthcare, so what it's called, took hold. And I think over 2,000 people at the clinic were put onto puberty blockers, and almost all of them then went on to what's called cross-sex hormones and surgeries. Now, that doesn't include a lot of other people who've been treated in a similar way in private clinics, by the way, or in Scotland. And people were whistleblowers, there was concern, there was pushback. A lot of these are now coming out. A big lobby group called Stonewall, according to the Times newspaper anyway, did their best to stop information spreading that was raising question marks about whether puberty blockers were the right treatment. And the other thing, of course, that was, you know, didn't escape people's notice is that a lot of teenagers find adolescence very, very difficult. And this cohort of mostly girls included an awful lot of autistic children, bullied children, some of them abused children, self-harming children, anorexic children. Now, was the gender issue the cause of that, or a symptom of all that? And should you maybe get into counselling them a little bit, or just waiting? But people who have raised those arguments got slightly trampled, and this model of instant affirmation came in to be very powerful in the clinic. And that, I guess, led to Hannah starting her work, which she's going to talk to us about. Do you think is that a fair upsum, Andrew?
That's a very, very, very good explanation. Yes, absolutely. I think this sets the scene very well for her.
You know, I don't think any of us want to be unkind to anybody, but that's sort of a part of this story, I think.
Well, I think a lot of people also are just not very well informed. And I mean, I hope that, you know, by certainly reading her book, but certainly I hope also talking to her, we'll have a stronger idea of the issues.
Yes. So there you are. We were a little hesitant to do this, but we are called the scandal mongers. And some people think it's one of the biggest medical scandals for a long time, what took place at the Tavistock. And it's now all been closed down, by the way, both in Britain and Scotland. Not closed. The clinic's been closed, and puberty blockers are now going to be used only very, very occasionally. No longer the default treatment for children.
And I mean, her book, as you say, has been very influential. I mean, I think not only a bestseller and a prize winner, but I think it's changed a lot of thinking within government and within the health service.
It has, but not only in government, in the opposition. You know, the Labour Party, there was a debate on the recent CAS report, and the Labour health spokesman, who's probably going to be in charge of the NHS in a few months, said he changed his mind. He didn't think puberty blockers were right, and he thanked Hannah personally for this. And, you know, she got a lot of stick, I'm sure she'll talk about this, from people who'd see themselves as being on the left for even trying to investigate this area, which goes to that thing we talked about before, tribalism and groupthink.
Yeah, well, also, the woman who chaired the committee, the CAS review, which has very much supported what Hannah was saying, and has been widely sort of congratulated for the report, she now says she can't go on public transport as a result of this, I mean, which is rather frightening and worrying. Another plea for just toleration and respect for other people's points of view.
Yeah, everybody involved in this wants to help kids who are ill, basically. It shouldn't have to be this nasty. It really shouldn't. All right, that's probably enough from us. Let's go to Hannah.
Yep, look forward to it.
Okay, here we go. Hannah, welcome. You are so welcome. And I just want to say, I can't think of any book in recent years that's made more of an impact on the debate about a subject, or indeed what politicians say in Parliament, than yours. So well done.
Well, yeah, thank you very much. It's very kind.
Honoured to have you with us.
No, thanks for having me. And I'm sorry it's taken so long.
No, well, it's a good time to talk to you because I think you've got a new edition coming out, or maybe it's just come out.
Mm-hmm. And we've just had the CAS review, so perfect.
Yeah, big week.
Well, big week for you, yes. Well, thanks for taking the time. I just want to take a lot of people, maybe especially outside Britain, won't know some of the basics of this. So, simple question, I guess. When did you get involved and why did you get involved with this most complicated story?
Well, and what is the story?
Well, so we start with what is the story? So the story, I suppose, is the story of how a specialist NHS service designed to help children distressed about their gender went so badly wrong, and how so many people in that service and in the wider NHS trust that it was part of, and bosses in the central NHS, politicians, regulators, the media helped them get it so badly wrong and didn't stop what was going on. And as we've heard, what really went on is over the last couple of decades, we've allowed vulnerable children to be prescribed a drug, puberty blockers, known colloquially, for which there really isn't an evidence base that shows they're either safe in this context or clinically effective. So really something very badly has gone wrong. I formally got involved probably in 2019, but I'd around the autumn of 2018 had really sparked my interest. And that was when it became apparent that there was a report that had been submitted to the Tavistock and Portman Trust, which housed the Gender Identity Development Service, GIDS, which had set out some concerns. And it didn't say very much, this report, but it said that the trust was going to be investigating it. And then a couple of months later, that some of the contents was leaked to the newspapers, to the Sunday Times, I believe. And it was really quite shocking, the content. Now, I didn't know whether it was true or not, but it struck me as quite extraordinary that you'd have, you know, not one whistleblower, which is quite rare in the NHS anyway, but several. And I can't remember at the time whether it said it was 10, but it was 10, who'd all gone and relayed their concerns to a psychiatrist called David Bell, who also worked in the Tavistock, but not in that service.
Just to be clear, these people relaying these concerns 4 or 5 years ago, they worked at the Tavistock.
Yeah, absolutely. So they all worked in GIDS. Some had just about left by the time they spoke to Dr. Bell, but they had all worked there, and they set out really quite serious concerns about safeguarding. I mean, they were clinical concerns, right? Not questioning the identity of these children. So I just thought, well, why is this not getting absolutely tons of coverage? And that's where it started. And then there started a series of films with my then colleague, Deborah Cohen. We did 4 films in across 2019 and 20, and then I took that on myself, and for the next 4 years for my sins.
And at this point you're working for Newsnight, which for those who don't know is one of the BBC's premier investigative, or it was, investigative brands. I'm sorry, it's been slightly downgraded now, hasn't it? But It's a very well-respected organization and program. Did you find amongst your colleagues, because we've already mentioned this was a very politicized area, even before you started looking into it, did any of your colleagues question your decision to investigate this, or were they very supportive?
I think I draw a distinction between Newsnight and then the wider BBC. So we were very, very fortunate in Newsnight that we had an amazing editor, Esme Wren. And then after Esme left, I was hugely supported by the subsequent editor, Stuart McLean. And our colleagues were very, very supportive within the programme. And I believe, you know, really quite proud of the work that's taken place. In the wider BBC, it wasn't that we openly received any pushback, but unlike with other really quite significant stories, which, I mean, I don't think there's any question that this is or was, it wasn't promoted. So it wouldn't be like a Panorama. So the flagship documentary series of the BBC is called Panorama. If they've got a big story, you will see that across every single BBC news platform across the whole day. You know, it'll be on radio bulletins, on all the different radio stations. It will be on the front page of the news website. It will be in the television news bulletins. And that just didn't happen with this story. We did always have an online piece, but I mean, at a battle. And sometimes they really weren't very easy to find. But, you know, it wasn't actively promoted or supported across the wider organisation, which is different from being blocked, which is very different from being blocked.
No, of course, I understand. I was going to ask about the people who you spoke to, because I think you spoke to more than just those initial whistleblowers. There's a sense, I think, in some ways, that looking into this makes you anti-trans. You don't like or want to help trans-identified, gender-distressed children. So I think it's true, isn't it, that most of the people who actually gave you your information were themselves very enthusiastic about helping children like that.
Well, I think everybody I spoke to cares about this group of children. They obviously disagree on how you best do that. But no one could be described as anti-trans or anti-gender-questioning children. And in fact, you know, some of the people I spoke to who are themselves now trans adults, I've had only positive comments back from them saying, you know, we might disagree on aspects of the story, but you've listened with compassion and open-mindedness and reflected, you know, different views fairly. And that means a huge amount to me. So actually, I think anybody that's read the book, whether they're trans or not, I don't think I've never received an accusation of transphobia. But of course, I have been called transphobic many, many times. And I think this is part of the massive problem of reporting the story and why probably so many people didn't, because and why the clinicians who raised their concerns first of all in the service and then, you know, took them outside had to do so, because they were raising very, very normal clinical concerns, actually, that you would in any service. You know, are our interventions safe and effective, but also are they right for any given young person when that person may have so much else going on for them? So this accusation of transphobia has been used to shut down any questioning of a treatment. It's not about, but no one has questioned either the strength of feeling or that person's identity, or whether people have the right to transition at all. I mean, that's not part of it. And it's a unique feature, I think, of this, that we've always approached it, and I've always approached it as a healthcare story, which I think it is. And in any other story where you might be questioning the validity and the efficacy of a treatment, by doing that, I can't think of a single example where the reaction would be, well, you hate that patient population. You know, say we have a cancer drug and actually we say, well, hang on, there's no long-term follow-up. It's never gone through a trial. It's actually harmed people. You wouldn't go, oh, you hate people with cancer. It just, it's really quite odd. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I do very much so. I was actually rereading Hadley Freeman's initial review of your book from about a year ago nearly now. Mm. And she said a lot of this boils down to what you think a child means when they say they are gender distressed or they think they're in the wrong body. Do you instantly affirm that? Instantly put them on a pathway to blocking puberty, cross-sex hormones, surgery, or do you ask them to reflect, take time, consider other things that might be causing them issues in their lives, autism, abuse, perhaps they're gay and they don't understand what that means yet. And I remember that review itself going on Twitter, and this would have been about a year ago.
February last year.
Absolute hatred that was unleashed on Hadley Freeman. I think, didn't she leave her, I think she left her job either at The Guardian over that, or maybe it was just before that, but it was certainly over that issue. So,
oh, yes. I mean, she did leave The Guardian over this issue. I mean, that piece was in the Sunday Times, so she'd left by then. Yes. I mean, we both did. It's baffling, and, you know, and it's, I mean, you know, the CAST report came out last week, and I mean, while I think it's a brilliant piece of work, and society owes Dr. Hilary Cassar an enormous debt of gratitude, but it has been sort of slightly infuriating to see vast swathes of the media and certain professions now say, oh, if only we'd known. And like, we've been talking about this for years. Like, you absolutely did know. The fact that it's taken such an eminent paediatrician to confirm all that. I mean, you know, it's great that it's happened, but...
So do you think the CAST report has, in a sense, laid the issue to rest, or do you think there's still going to be issues raised?
I don't think it's laid it to rest. I think it's very encouraging that there seems to be at least the majority of consensus now, both across the media. I mean, The Guardian, for example,'s coverage in the last week or so has been, you know, extraordinary compared to what's gone on before. I'm not sure the BBC has really covered itself in glory still. I mean, you know, reporting on the day, but I haven't really seen any proper engagement subsequently.
Well, I think it's one of the problems, and you very much get into this in the book, and I'd love you to talk to us about these. There's some details of this. Lobby groups getting very, very closely involved in patient care, especially Mermaids, possibly also Stonewall. I mean, and you seem to have identified instances where Mermaids in particular were directly involving themselves in the care of patients. And that, of course, those groups were very widely supported by, you know, maybe well-meaning people, actors, comedians, some politicians, some musicians. And, you know, to go against them made you look, you know, a bit cruel and a bit unkind. And because,
yeah, I mean, just to finish Andrew's point, though, and then to answer that, Phil, I mean, so there does seem to be sort of a broad, very calm reporting subsequent to the report's release. And also in the House of Commons, we have seen, you know, presumably the next health secretary in Wes Streeting really being very strong and supporting Hilary Cass. I mean, there were a couple of MPs from across the House who disagree. Is it the end of it? I don't think it is, sadly, because, I mean, the reaction from some trans groups and even academics and unions has been quite extraordinary. I mean, I've just updated my piece in the New Statesman, actually, but we've had some extraordinary claims made by trans groups and their supporters that the review team ignored all but two research studies which have looked into the use of puberty blockers and hormones in young people. I mean, it's demonstrably false. I mean, it documents which studies were included and why. And they only excluded from the synthesis those that were rated very low because they're so unreliable. So, that, you know, that's how medicine works. That's how systematic evidence reviews works. They've also claimed that Dr. Cass is trying to withdraw all medical care for under 25s. Again, absolutely no evidence of this whatsoever in the report. And we have this extraordinary situation now where a group of academics have written, you know, a protest letter. We have veteran gay rights campaigner Peter Tatchell organising a demonstration in Parliament to bring back puberty blockers. And I just find it baffling. I mean, what? I don't understand why. Of course, there is disagreement, but everybody, I think, wants what's best for this group of young people. Having heard that we have badly let them down, that the evidence base just isn't there, that it might not be safe and we need to do better research, I don't understand why the response would be, let's bring back this intervention for which we have no evidence that it helps these young people. It baffles me. It genuinely does. Back to your point, Phil, about support groups. I mean, it's interesting. I spoke to Hilary Cass upon publication for a very short interview, you know, as she did a couple. And I think we have to remember it's not exceptional that lobby groups, interest groups, whatever you want to say, patient groups are involved in shaping NHS services. Very normal. It's seen as good practice to involve service users. But she says that she told me, you know, that should not be to the extent that you ignore the evidence. And that seems to have what's happened here. That seems to have been what has happened here. And yes, you know, mermaids were very, very involved with JIDS. They had a very strange relationship in that they sort of grew up together. They were sort of like childhood friends, because Mermaids actually was formed out of a group of parents whose kids were being seen at the service. And in the very early days, everybody got on very well and they had the same interests. And even the founder of JIDS, Domenico De Celi, he was a patron of the service and of the charity. And then, you know, things started to diverge. I think it's slightly more complicated than Mermaids influenced all of clinical decision making at JIDS and they got what they wanted, because that wasn't always the case. But I think there was this more, they were certainly influential, and I think their presence was felt by all clinicians, regardless of how they themselves personally practiced, you know, sort of little person hovering on the shoulder. And I think what they did, there was this sort of fear of how mermaids and other groups might react if they changed practice. And we saw that a couple of times over the history of JIDS, where nothing was committed to paper, for example. So when new information came to light that was really important, that should be shared with families and children, it often wasn't, because unless you had been personally present when that information became known, you might not know it, so you couldn't pass it on. And this happened on a couple of occasions. So one was when data came back from JIDS' own research on puberty blockers, and it showed that at that point, at least, everybody that had started treatment with the blocker who was eligible then went on to cross-sex hormones. Now, that's quite important that you tell families that, because that's about gaining informed consent, but that was never written down. Similarly, in the autumn of 2016, I mean, this is years ago, they had a visit from a surgeon who was the UK's top surgeon at performing vaginoplasty, so gender reassignment surgery for men transitioning to be trans women. And he said, look, if you block puberty too early in some of these boys, it makes it really, really difficult for them to transition, actually, contrary to what you might think, because the surgery that we can perform is much more difficult. It's much riskier because we don't have enough tissue to work with, because the penis hasn't grown enough. And it's risky and the results aren't as good. Now, again, that's not telling children, their families, don't do something or do something, but it's really important information to have when you're making a decision. And it took 3.5 years for that to be, so 3 years, sorry, to be codified and passed on to every single family. And we've just seen it buried in the appendices in the CAS report are the reflections of the multi-professional review group, which was a group independent of JIDS that was brought in to check that all referrals for puberty blockers for under 16s had gone through a particular process. This was brought in 2021. And in that, so up until last month, presumably, when the service was still open, this information was still not being passed on. And clinicians were unable to correct parents' and children's assumptions about what we do and don't know about the blocker. I mean, it's really quite shocking, really.
Well, I think Mermaid's website a few days ago was still saying puberty blockers were reversible.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Well, no, the honest answer is we don't know. I mean, it seems highly unlikely that they are fully reversible in every sense. Where they are reversible is physically, if you stop, then things should kick back in again. I mean, this is how they're used when we treat precocious puberty. So when children start puberty really, really early, and that's what they're licensed for kids. So if you're under eight and female, or under nine and male, you take the puberty blocker because your body, your brain, nothing's really ready at that point. So you take it for as short a period as possible, and then you stop, and then your body goes through puberty. But
can you go through puberty at 20 or 25? You can't, can you?
No, because what happens is, well, you really shouldn't be taking it that late anyway, because it has, I mean, accepted impact on bones. But what happens here is, A, children tend to be older, so they tend to be in adolescence when they take the blocker. And so there's all kinds of different cognitive processes going on at that point. So it's cognitively, it's an enormous period in development. It's the development of your sexual identity. It's when your bone density is increasing at the most rapid rate in our lives, all kinds of things. But most importantly, the vast majority, you know, in excess of 95% don't come off. They go straight onto synthetic hormones. So you never go through the puberty of your biological sex. And for those who start blockers early enough, it means that you're infertile because your sperm and your eggs haven't matured enough to ever to ever, you know, be capable of producing a baby. But so, you know, there's a very respected consultant neuropsychologist called Sally Baxendale, and you know, she has 500 peer-reviewed papers, and she said when she's read that puberty blockers are fully reversible, she thought, oh wow, this is extraordinary, because I've been studying the brain for my entire career, so let me see what evidence there is, and there is none. And she said, well, it, you know, we have these various windows of development in our lives, you know, some around two with language and food and things like that. And there's this major one in adolescence. And it's widely accepted that you can't skip a window. Like, it's there and then it closes. So we just don't know. We just don't know. And I think the most awful thing is that the people, the professionals working in this field, have really not bothered to try to find out over 25 years. And that's quite, you know, staggering.
That is extraordinary. It really is. I remember the Cara Bell case, which was the first thing that I sort of noticed. And this is a woman, she had gone through, I'm sure you know the case well, you should explain it, but she was the first detransitioner that I noticed in the media. Is that a trend that's growing? And was her case something that you thought was important when you were starting your work?
Her case was absolutely massive. I mean, that started after Newsnight had started covering this. The case was absolutely enormous because it brought the attention of JIDS to the world, really. I remember being at the High Court, and so I sat through both days of evidence. And it was very weird. It was that kind of weird hybrid post-COVID. We weren't in lockdown, but we were in this kind of weird thing. So we weren't all allowed to be in the same room as Cara Bell and the Tavistock team. But there was a room for journalists and a room for some others, and the audio was terrible. And we're going, and a couple of times there were just gasps. I mean, it was extraordinary. But what that case showed, and it did ultimately lose on appeal, but what it showed was that by that point, 30 years of being open, JIDS had failed to collect any meaningful data on the young people they were meant to be helping and this core treatment pathway. So they were unable to tell the court how many young people had commenced treatment with puberty blockers, how old they were, what sex they were, how many had gone on to cross-sex hormones. Really, they were able to give 1 year of data, and the judges, in true British understatement, commented that that was surprising.
What did happen to Cara? She'd gone through blocking, cross-sex. I mean, maybe she
just... So she attended JIDS from about the age of 14, 14 or 15, and after three appointments was referred to endocrinologists at University College London hospitals, who often get ignored in this, but it's a very important part of the story, and prescribed puberty blockers and later prescribed testosterone whilst still under the care of JIDS, and then in adult services had a double mastectomy, which she then came to regret all of it. So that's what happened with Kira, and subsequently.
What is her case, though, that she had other issues that were not being addressed?
Yeah, her case, well, the core of the case was that young people, children couldn't consent to this treatment because so little was known about it that you couldn't give informed consent anyway, because nobody knows what the long-term impact was. But the other part was a child could not consent to things that it couldn't possibly properly comprehend, i.e., the loss of fertility, the loss of sexual function and being able to orgasm as an adult. You know, how could a 13-year-old possibly make an informed decision about something they've never experienced or appreciate the significance of? And initially she won. The High Court ruled that, yes, it was highly unlikely that those under 16 could provide informed consent, and even more so at 13, 14. That was overturned on appeal, not actually saying, yes, they can provide consent, but they said that there had been overreach by the court and it was up to the doctors to make that decision about whether any given child could. But that's safeguards were put in place subsequently, and it really was a game changer. It really was a game changer. In terms of, is it something that's growing? It's really difficult to answer that question. It seems to be. I mean, for the updated paperback, I spoke to a psychiatrist at Charing Cross Gender Identity Clinic, the adult clinic. He said it's growing, but I suppose the number going through the clinic is growing also, to be fair. There's been a complete shift in those who are detransitioning. People have always detransitioned. I mean, ironically, the Portman Clinic, which is part of the same trust that housed JIDS and actually the Charing Cross Clinic, had groups for detransitioners in the early 2000s. So we've always known transition doesn't work for everybody. And, you know, he said, all right, I'm being brought coffee. Isn't that lovely?
Oh, that's lovely.
Thank you. Pick up again. So he said that there's been a complete shift.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
So where it was older trans women who were previously detransitioning, the people now who are considering it or who are largely female, they're still young, and almost always have had some kind of adverse trauma or experience in childhood, whether physical, sexual, emotional. And the numbers are increasing. They're in the double digits every year. And I believe the last, so 2023, of those females that were considering or were detransitioning, half had been to JIDS to start with. Now, I think we get a bit hung up on the numbers because I'm not really convinced that we can ever measure it. So, A, it's very difficult because lots of people wouldn't still be attending the gender clinic if they changed their minds. Secondly, I've spoken with people who have tried or have considered it and they've got no support from those clinics. But thirdly, what does it even mean? Because you do have people, I've spoken to them, who have fully transitioned, fully medically and surgically. They regret that decision. They're not happy. But they can't detransition because society will never perceive them to be their birth sex ever again because of how they appear. So, you know, there are females who have fully transitioned and lived their lives as trans men, or their short lives, they're still in their 20s. They've had genital surgery. They know they're female, but they just have to get on because, and also the even to readdress the hormones and everything, if you've had a hysterectomy, it's just so difficult. So I think there's this real concentration and desire to know how many people detransition. I don't think we'll ever know, but I also don't think the term is particularly helpful.
Interesting.
So have people been misdiagnosed? I mean, have there been other problems? I mean, they thought it was to do with their identity and it was something like autism. I mean, there seems to be quite a close link with autism.
I'm not sure you could say they've been diagnosed as having a gender identity problem and it's autism. I mean, it's absolutely the case that autistic children and young people are very overrepresented in this population. And according to JIDS's own data, that it's a few years ago now, but they estimated that about 35% of those referred to the service displayed moderate to severe autistic traits, which is not quite the same as an autism diagnosis, but you know, it's still quite a striking statistic. What Dr. Cass identified and what so many clinicians have been saying for years is this phenomenon called diagnostic overshadowing, which was where when a young person went to JIDS who absolutely was distressed about their gender identity or was questioning it, no one questions that. That is very real. Often they were contending with some other, sometimes very serious difficulties at the same time. So that might be depression, anxiety, eating disorders, even psychosis. And what tended to happen was JIDS would only try to address the gender difficulty, assuming that these other things were being dealt with somewhere else, usually by child and adolescent mental health services, CAMHS. And that didn't happen. So the whole system failed. This is a systemic failure. It's not about one clinic. And CAMHS, sometimes, you know, their resources are squeezed. Funding of children and adolescent mental health services and services generally has been woeful and cut. And so sometimes when they saw a young person who was on their books and very troubled, and that person said, oh, I'm questioning my gender, they went, oh, well, you can go to JIDS. We'll get you off our books. They got loads of money. They're a specialist national service. You do it. Now, it was meant to be the case that young person should be seen at both. But I had clinicians tell me, you know, former JIDS clinicians say, CAMHS would actually say to us, look, if you need us to keep that case open for them to be with you, we will do that, but we aren't going to see them.
Why did JIDS have money and CAMHS didn't?
Well, JIDS might disagree with the fact they had money, but they had a guaranteed revenue stream. So they had this centrally commissioned guaranteed contract from NHS England, and that led to other difficulties. But CAMHS's money was being cut and more children wanted to use it. So they had to do more with less. And so did JIDS, to be fair. I mean, as referrals grew, they were given more money, but the solution to more and more distressed and complex cases seemed to be, let's employ lots of junior members of staff. And now that was at the suggestion of NHS England. And it strikes me as a completely bizarre solution to the problem. Because actually in the early days, JIDS was only staffed by very, very experienced clinicians, you know, who would have the level of experience where in other parts of the NHS you might be running a whole service. It was never run by junior, inexperienced staff. Now, of course, you can have junior, experienced staff, like you can in any organisation, and you need new blood coming through, but you can't run an organisation on it, which increasingly there was an over-reliance on these inexperienced staff.
Can I ask you about your book a little bit more? Because I guess you've done all these reports on Newsnight. You think you would like to write a book. What happened when you tried to?
I'm not sure I ever want. I'd like to write a book. I got to the point where I was talking to my old boss, who's a friend of mine, Innes Bowen, and I said, "Oh, you know, I know all this stuff. What do I do?" And actually, I couldn't. This sounds really cheesy. I don't mean it to be, but it just bothered me so much. I knew so much, and I couldn't. I've had trouble sleeping about it. I felt very burdened by it, but not in a. I didn't feel bad that people have told me. I just thought I can't keep this to myself. It's too important, and people need to know. And that was why I wanted to write the book. I had no idea how difficult it would be to actually do. But so I was introduced to a wonderful agent, Toby Mundy, who immediately got it. He got the issue. He recognised how important it was. So I wrote a book proposal, very long one, about 17,000 words, which wasn't necessarily a blueprint for the book, but it gave a flavour of the writing, and everything would be double sourced and based on documentary evidence, etc. And that was sent to a number of publishers. As you'd expect, he went to the biggest publishers first, those that he thought would take the project on. And I hadn't quite realised until a little bit later, but yes, they all said no. And I saw some of the responses that came back. But in the end, 22 publishers said no or just didn't reply at all. Unfortunately, the 23rd Swift Press said yes. But
what did they say, these messages back? They didn't think it was worth publishing because it was wrong? Well, because it was controversial?
No, I mean, that was the striking thing, that none of them were negative. So one was, this is really important. You've got to tell it. I'm sure you will. Not said in parentheses, but not with us, because we have other authors who might not like it. There were references to junior members of staff. One publisher who did want it, it had to go to the CEO of the publishing house, which was almost unheard of, apparently, and they ruled it was too controversial. So I just found... I don't think large swathes of the media have covered themselves in glory with this story. However, reading some of those responses and hearing them via Toby was so much worse in the publishing industry, because I think once you've really engaged with a proposal that's that long and it was quite clear what was happening, you're sort of complicit by that point. You're saying, I totally recognise something has gone very badly wrong here, and we've potentially harmed children, but I'm not gonna do anything about it.
It does sound a little bit like the Guardian story, doesn't it? When junior members of staff, very committed to the cause of trans rights, celebrities, people wearing t-shirts, leave trans kids alone, you freaks. I think that was a famous one by National Treasurer David Tennant. Mm. There was that feeling that only cruel and nasty and probably right-wing people who just don't like anything that's gay or trans would want to read this.
I think it was worse than that. I think it was worse than that, because it wasn't coming from a true feeling of I support this. It was coming from cowardice. In fact, they saw they didn't.
Well, can I perhaps come in here?
I think if you truly believe it, that's one thing. To actually see it, not believe it, but be.
Well, speaking as someone in publishing, I mean, it's a big problem, not just in this issue, and a whole series of issues where the people at the bottom in some ways are shaping attitudes at the top. And they're either, as you say, like the BBC, slightly pushing it to the side, or they're saying no, or forcing them to actually cancel books. Mm-hmm. I think the interesting thing here, too, is that it made the reputation of Swift Press, this book. I mean, it's been a great success. It's been nominated for prizes. I think it's changed attitudes. I mean, Swift Press, to whom I saw a lot of books, have sort of really now begun to forge a reputation in this area, and others are now beginning to follow them, seeing that they're not going to get firebombed or whatever. So in some ways, it's been very important in shaping publishing strategy.
Yeah, I hope so. And Swift you know, they're great, and Deanna and Mark are absolutely lovely people alongside that. I mean, it's interesting because Mark in particular sometimes gets abuse as well, you know, oh, he's right wing and blah, blah, blah. No, in fact, they publish books they don't agree with. You don't have to agree with it. They just believe in free speech and that these arguments should be aired. You know, and yes, it has paid off for them, and not just Time to Think, but yeah, a number of other books, and I'm delighted that they're doing so well.
It doesn't seem that long ago when that sort of attitude to free speech was normal.
Yeah.
And I've sat in meetings at The Guardian when it was normal, and when I worked at Panorama and indeed Newsnight in the 90s, it was normal. Mm. And that's troubling to me, that it isn't normal anymore. It's quite rare to find people that open-minded in our business.
Yeah, it's really troubling, and it's something that really worries me on a wider level. And I worry about what people believe impartiality is as well. I mean, you know, all journalists, we're all people. We all have our own thoughts and own lives that shape how we think and feel. But there seems to be not a commitment to free speech, but just a growing intolerance. So you don't have to agree with someone all the time for a start. And just because someone doesn't think what you do, it doesn't make them a bad person either. And I see this just creeping in. It's like, no. You know.
And a lack of respect for experts, you know, we all sort of, you know, we're all experts because we can write a review on Amazon. And it seems to be a sense of not trusting people who do know what they're talking about.
I mean, for me, a low point in all this, I don't know whether you'd agree, was that ITV drama, Butterfly. Now, we've talked a lot about the role of drama in pushing forward great causes. We talked to Nick Wallace about the post office scandal a few months ago. And, you know, it's incredible when those emotional, beautifully made shows can really capture the imagination and engage the emotions of a big audience. Butterfly, it was shockingly one-sided, and all of the boxes were ticked. Born in the wrong body, plays with the wrong toys. If you don't affirm this person's gender identity, they'll kill themselves. It'll be your fault. Do you think ITV should take that program down? Because I certainly do.
I didn't know it was still up. Well, look, ITV aren't solely culpable here, are they? The BBC similarly broadcast a program to children, I Am Leo, celebrating transition at 12 years old and that puberty blockers were fully reversible and just a pause. And there have been many other programs.
Is that still up on the BBC?
Don't quote me. I believe so, but I'm not 100% sure. You know, that won awards. And I don't know if Butterfly did. I can't remember. I saw it at the time. I think
it was beautifully made, emotionally manipulative television.
Well, and Mermaids were key, or Susie Green, at least, who was in charge of Mermaids for such a long time, was a key consultant there. I think.
Well, it was based on Susie Green's life story, wasn't it?
Yes.
The son who wanted to transition and was, I believe she took him to Thailand to have his,
to
be castrated. Maybe that's a loaded term, to have gender affirming surgery on his 16th birthday.
Yeah.
She's apparently very happy. So, but maybe that's a rare example of it being appropriate for children.
Well, I think it's interesting because there's a wider point, which is obviously Susie Green is more than entitled to her view on this issue, and of course it is shaped by her own personal experience and that of Jackie, her now daughter, but she isn't a medic, so Susie has a very particular view of what constitutes the right pathway, which is understandable, but it shouldn't dictate practice across the board. And I think Butterfly and other things and the media coverage of this issue, it actually sort of typifies the general problem, which is this: the whole area has been treated with exceptionalism. I mean, you'll both know that we are told to be so cautious as journalists when talking about suicide. I mean, generally, you know, you never talk about what might be the motive. You don't talk about methods. We are so careful about it.
Absolutely. And day one of my journalistic training course, 1982, BBC yeah. Television Centre, day one.
Exactly. And yet, somehow, you know, and it's happened on the BBC, it's happened in The Guardian, it's happened, you know, those really, you know, they're there for a reason and they're right. They're ignored when it comes to this. And it's like, and similarly, in medicine, we don't tend to roll out drugs that haven't been tested properly on children. And yet that's happened here. I mean, we use, there's so much conflation that goes on, but we use off-label drugs all the time on kids because we don't test them. But it's generally a question of dosage. You know, we haven't tested paracetamol on children because, you know, we test them on adults. So we say, oh, well, you have it at a half dose. And what Hilary Cass says very, very clearly in her report is this is not normal practice. It's been absolute overreach here of using a drug licensed for a particular purpose for a completely different purpose. Like that's not how the NHS operates. And so there's been this exceptionalism everywhere, like with the regulator, with politicians. I mean, I'm so struck. There's a few kind of events in this story which just I can't even shake. And one of them was the appearance of Bernadette Wren, who was, I guess, number two at JITS behind. She was in the senior leadership team with Polly Carmichael. And she appears before Parliament in 2015 in front of Maria Miller's Women in Equality Select Committee. And she explains that the children coming forward to JITS are not the children of the original Dutch studies, which pioneered the medical transitioning of children. They're very distressed. They're very complicated. Some of them live in care. And yet they give them puberty blockers anyway. And she uses the line, we have no record of turning anyone down. Now, that's not to say that everybody went on to puberty blockers. They didn't. But and she's sitting alongside Susie Green from Mermaids. And the response of the committee is not to say, but what evidence do you have to be doing this? Are you following them up? It's to say, why are you so cautious? Why aren't you giving cross-sex hormones at 14? You know, there's been such a dereliction of normal inquiry.
What's likely to happen now, do you think? I mean, have things changed? I mean, what do you hope might happen now?
I think things have changed across large swathes of society. I think difficult to tell. It's only a week. I think there's a real opportunity to really improve care for this group of children and young people, and who have been so badly let down by those who should have been caring for them. But there's going to be no quick fixes. I mean, there are 5,000 to 6,000 children on the waiting list, and some of them have been waiting for years already, 4 years, 5 years, without any access to any help whatsoever, which is shameful. They're not going to come off that waiting list anytime soon, because it's really hard to recruit to these new hubs that have opened. Another one's opening later in the year in Bristol, but it's just going to take time. And so I think what is being proposed is really positive. Because it's not ruling out, it's saying that, you know, transition will be the pathway for some. It's not cut and dry, but for most, it won't be. And that's really going back to what we knew from 40, 50 years ago, which was in any of those old studies, flawed as they all are, you took a group of children distressed about their gender. Some would always transition, would transition as adults. The majority wouldn't. And that seems to have got lost over the years. And the majority of those that wouldn't would grow up to be gay or lesbian. So I think what's being proposed is positive, but it's just going to take so long to implement it. And there has to be a decent level of oversight, which has been so lacking over the last 15 years. You know, NHS England need to step up and take some responsibility. And I think at the first sign of any trouble or pushback, they need to just step in and squash it. I mean, one of the things that when I spoke with Dr. Hilary Cass last week in a short interview, she was saying that, you know, this proposal that a national national group of clinicians will have to sign off any decision for hormones for those 16 and up. The idea behind that is who haven't been the clinicians of that young person. And the idea behind that is to remove all this massive variation that's been in the past, where whether a young person got blockers or not totally depended on which clinician they saw, you know, and they could have them after two appointments or one appointment in some cases. So the idea is that wherever a child is in the country, they will still have to be seen by this. There will be some consistency at least. But we have the private sector pushing back. As I said earlier, we have trans groups pushing back. We have academics pushing back.
What's the situation abroad? I mean, how do we compare with other countries?
Or indeed Scotland?
Well, Scotland is doing its own thing, it seems. There were some very striking comments made in the debate over the Gender Recognition Reform Bill in Scotland, where the SNP government were saying, well, the CAS review, which obviously at that point hadn't reported, but we had the interim findings, the CAS review is related to England, so it doesn't apply here. And my view on that at the time was, it's not about English children, it's about the medical practice. You know, the evidence base is the evidence base, wherever children live, anywhere in the world. And every national body that has undertaken a systematic review of their evidence base has come up with the same conclusion, which is that it is weak. You know, that's happened in Sweden, that's happened in Finland. Norway have taken those systematic reviews and, you know, implemented them, if you like. So it's a bizarre argument that just because NHS England commissioned it, that the same results don't apply to children in Scotland. So that'll be interesting to see what they do. I know that there seems to be quite a lot of pressure on them now. In terms of the rest of the world, well, I think we have this growing and quite large divergence between a growing number of European countries and North America and Australia, effectively. So Norway, Sweden, Finland, bits of France. Germany's a bit of a strange one because they're sort of pushing forward with self-ID, but in terms of puberty blockers and hormones, are expressing caution. Denmark have all looked at this and decided there needs to be more caution. Of course, these young people need help and they are distressed, but the first point of the first treatment, if you like, should be talking therapies, not medication, which has been the case in the past. So there is there's a road back towards, well, bring it in line with all other areas of medicine, which it's gone so badly awry. That doesn't seem to be happening in the US, in Canada, in Australia. But
has your book been published in those countries?
It's about to be published in the States. I think it's going to be early July now, June, July. It's not formally published in Australia, but you can buy it. And I've been on the ABC a couple of times and things like that. But it's just baffling because, as I say, I think, you know, to give people the benefit of the doubt, even those most affirmative clinicians, I mean, I don't think I want to believe anybody wants to harm children. So let's assume they don't and they really believe this. I just, like, what do they need to see in terms of the evidence that's not been presented already that suggests need for caution?
We appreciate we've had nearly an hour of your time. One more question, I guess, from me, which is, we talked about the anger around this issue and people being cancelled and fired and threatened and shouted at. I always felt particularly sad for Rachel Rooney, the children's author.
Yeah.
I've come to know through social media only. But her story was brutal, I think. Mm-hmm. But above and beyond all that, isn't this just kind of tragedy of people with good intentions? Most people involved thought they were doing the right thing, wanted to be kind, didn't want to be judgmental. And for some reason, it became part of the kind of toolkit of decent progressive people to believe this stuff, like you might believe other things that, you know, like women should have abortion rights, or you should be the least to asylum seekers, or, well, we obviously got to give trans kids puberty blockers. It's just part of the same list. And yet it was profoundly different. And I can't quite get my head around it.
Well, no oversight is the key, isn't it?
I think no oversight. I think you're right, Phil, that it stems from good intentions, of course, and definitely in the early years, there appeared to be this treatment which would help this very distressed, small, rare group of children, and that's totally understandable. And I think what's harder, these are professionals that have dedicated their working careers to helping children. So, yeah, of course they wanted what was best for them. I think what's harder to get your head, I find harder to get my head around is why, when data started to come back, and even just, you know, the young people before your very eyes showed you that it didn't seem to be doing what you thought it was, why they're wasn't a change in direction, and why NHS England didn't demand to see proper data, and why when those brave clinicians who risked their careers to speak out did so, it took so long to for the adults to come back in the room. And it's just, so I think it was well-intentioned, but there came a point where it doesn't explain it. And I while you keep going, and even now, you have to be a true believer, I guess, but whilst ignoring everything else. I mean, there's a brilliant Finnish clinician, Dr. Rita Kaltiala, who has been incredibly brave. And it's really interesting, actually, in Finland, the changes that towards more caution have come from the gender clinic themselves. It hasn't been forced upon them. They said, well, something's going on here. Like, these aren't the kids of the Dutch studies and what have you, that, and we're not getting the same results. Like, so maybe we shouldn't be doing the same thing. And she gave an interview quite recently to Barry Weiss in the US and said, I couldn't understand it because I knew that my colleagues in other gender clinics around the world were seeing exactly what we had, which was this sudden shift to very distressed teenage girls. But no one was speaking out about it. And we were encouraged to kind of disbelieve what was before our very own eyes and all of our past medical experience. Now, she's actually a psychiatrist. She's a doctor. But she said, you know, sometimes I even had children in front of me saying, yeah, I'm really happy. But they weren't. And any objective measure showed that they weren't thriving. And it's really difficult to explain why that might be. I mean, one of the clinicians I've spoken to the most over the last 5 years, Dr. Anna Hutchinson, I think she's probably right. You know, she says, well, what does it mean to change your mind if you've been working in that system for a decade or not? It means you have to accept that whilst you've been trying to help children, in fact, you may have been harming them. And that's quite intolerable for most people. It's to live with yourself. And we don't, as human beings, we don't really like to admit we've made mistakes, and really quite big ones.
Well, as you say, we saw Wes Streeting, Labour's spokesperson on this, pretty much admitting that in Parliament, and fair play to him.
Absolutely.
As you say, he'll probably be the health secretary soon. But thank you so much. I mean, you've done, what a fascinating interview. But more important than that, thank you for what you've done on the book. You know, you brought rigour and fair-mindedness to such a difficult area. It must have been very, very hard.
And change people's thinking, which is, yeah, you know, quite an achievement.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Hope the book sells well everywhere. Especially
thank you.
America. Bye.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, I mean, absolutely fascinating. I mean, you know a lot more about this than I do, but I think it's really opened up the debate.
Yeah, I mean, we've had some great writers on our podcast. We've been really lucky, you know, writers who've written books and done investigative journalism that really changed things, both here and abroad. But Hannah's certainly one of them, isn't she?
Absolutely. No, I think it was right to do this subject. It'll be interesting to hear what people feel. But I think if we were going to have someone talking, she was the best possible person to do that.
She did mention, actually, and she had written elsewhere, that Newsnight, the BBC programme that supported her work and many other great investigative journalists, has been basically downgraded by the BBC to a sort of, well, talk show really now, which is such a shame. We praise investigative journalists all the time, and we've met quite a few of them on the podcast, but, you know, where are the new ones going to come from?
Yeah, absolutely. Very few opportunities. I mean, I suppose smaller magazines, but we're going to be talking to David Hooper about SLAPs, which are strategic lawsuits. What are they? Against something people. I've got to work out what it is. But I mean, these are
pestering people like you, Andrew.
Exactly.
Down the pestering.
Exactly. Powerful people trying to stop people speaking out. It all plays into this. I mean, that people won't be prepared to do these sort of investigative books because of the likely penalties and risks. But I thought also what was interesting, it wasn't that she didn't get support from, she got some support from Newsnight, but it was the BBC rather wanted to downplay things. I think that's quite revealing. And we've not always been very complimentary about the BBC on this, but I'm afraid that doesn't reflect very well on it.
No, it doesn't. And I think we said earlier, you know, people want to be kind. And the idea took root that the kind thing to do is always support trans campaigners for trans rights, trans healthcare, trans kids. And anybody who was raising questions was somehow not a nice person. I don't know. We mentioned The Guardian, or rather Hannah did. There was a great tweet I saw today, actually, from Suzanne Moore. You know Suzanne?
Yeah.
I've admired Suzanne for years. She's a doughty feminist writer. She was a pillar of The Guardian for decades. And she fell out with The Guardian over this very issue and claimed she was bullied out of the paper. A lot of the junior members signed a letter saying that she shouldn't be writing on this subject, and she went off. But she wrote,
Hadley Freeman.
Yes, Hadley Freeman is another. So it's, you know, the left, institutions of the left, like The Guardian, some might say the BBC, are being torn by this issue. But anyway, Suzanne tweeted today, it's funny how things change gradually, then suddenly. We've had Cass, now Stonewall is seen to be publicly feeding misinformation to MPs. Mermaids are heavily impacted. The wheels are coming off the bus.
Gosh. Well, maybe we should come back to this in a few months' time.
I'd love to talk to Suzanne. I really would. She's a great figure. Anyway, what's next week? I think it's Clive Irvin, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is. We've had Clive actually on the books for a while. We've got a plethora of people we've been recording and trying to sort of balance who we put in. But yeah, I think probably Clive. But we've got lots of very interesting, a variety of interesting talks. I mean, even a talk on women in Roman.
Yes, the scandals of ancient Rome, which I'm really looking forward to. And this is recommended by my dear wife, the librarian, Frances. And it's a really popular book amongst all her friends, all about the scandalous women of Rome. So that's going to be fun.
You can't say you don't get variety here.
You do.
I think we should call ourselves Heinz, 57 different varieties.
You should. And yes, Clive is going to be with us, probably, unless something comes out of, you know, suddenly rears up. And Clive is going to talk about hacking, the latest court cases, especially Prince Harry's court cases against the press, and the, you know, how the great British tabloids stand in all these legal battles. And whether Harry's right, I suppose. A lot of people think he isn't. Lady Colin Campbell had a real go at him the other week that he was trying to destroy the freedom of the press. I don't think Clive would agree with that.
No. I certainly think he has a strong case on certain issues, perhaps less so on protection, but on the way that he was treated and the hacking that went on, I think he has a certain justified grievance.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being with us. Love to know what you thought of Hannah and whether you think we should be doing more stories in this area, sort of sensitive social policy. It's a slightly new territory for us. And we hope enough of you will like it enough to come back next week.
Yep. And don't forget that pushing that like button, that subscribe button, the thanks button, all the new buttons that we've got.
Yes, lots of buttons, especially the one that says thanks, because that gives us a couple of dollars to Andrew and he needs a few new jumpers.
An audio.
Oh, yes, I need a decent mic. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team@podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.